So, you know, Bill says something in the section on step three. And I've often wondered what he means by this when he says self-centered and then his long dash, meaning he's going to kind of say the same thing again a different way, or egocentric, as people like to call it nowadays. Is he equating those? It's almost, the sentence is almost structured like he maybe is implying that we're talking about the same thing. Because as people like to call it nowadays, you know, I got to remember in 1939 when the big book was written, ego was not a word that was in the English language to the same way it is today. You know, there was Adler, just came about, and there was Freud, there was Jung, there was a few people that were using those words, people who'd had experience with them, maybe, but not a lot. Now you can Google ego. There's rock bands named with that in it. It's pretty much. So when I ask God to relieve me of the bondage of self, and enter into the fourth step to be rid of the things that are blocking me, I'm really going to start to having a process of self-reduction, of ego deflation. As the great therapist Harry Thiebaud, who worked with Wilson for a number of years, says that we must have ego reduction at depth. And he also talks about the amazing recuperative powers of the alcoholic ego, which is why we have the necessity of step 11, 12, and 10, 11, and 12, because of the reoccurrence, the chronic nature of this malady. It just reoccurs. It never goes away. We just treat it. And so in the resentment inventory, it's like they trick you into setting yourself up to dismantle the judgment machine that is the ego. Because that's what the ego does. It judges. It's the part of you that thinks you're right about everything. It's the part of you that it's the opinion generator inside of you. I don't know about most of you guys, but most alcoholics I know, we drink and do drugs and burn our lives to the ground till there's nothing left, and we come into AA and the first thing we get back is our opinion. it's amazing. I mean, we're all that way because you can be so surrendered one day and a week later it's like you know what's wrong with everybody, And so for ego reduction, self-reduction is a dismantling. And I can't imagine a more effective dismantling of the ego than to trick it into doing what it does best. And that's listing all its judgments. And that's what the resentment list is. It's the cases you've built on people. Right? So you're gonna list all, you're gonna list mom and how I'm right about her, and dad and how I'm right about him. And you're gonna just do the whole list, how you're right about all these people and how they're wrong and I'm right. And Wilson uses a term in the 12 steps and 12 traditions that he talks about how we have this sense of smug superiority, right? And a lot of us don't want to do this. It's funny the resistance that comes up. I've had guys that I've started on the resentment inventories, and they'll say things to me like, "I don't have any resentments." It's almost, which is, we all know, armed with information about ourselves, we know that's ridiculous. But I'm afraid to have resentments because that means that I'm weak. That means that people have actually hurt me. That means that someone's got to me. And I don't want to admit that. I'd like to be the ego wants to fancy itself bulletproof and above the herd. When the truth is, I'm hurt a lot. There was a great speaker, Indian John from Boston years ago, and he used to have this wonderful saying. He said, I'm overly sensitive, I'm easily hurt, and I don't suffer well, and I don't suffer alone. And that's really true. Only I'm not really sensitive. I told my sponsor that one time. I said, sensitive. He says, sensitive? Aren't sensitive people sensitive to other people's feelings? You're only sensitive to your own. We call that self-centered. So I'm making a list of all these judgments, and I start to dismantle them, especially in This Was Our Course. When I, you know, when Clancy talks about alcoholism being a disease of perception, this is where it's a big paradigm shift here. I've often told guys I sponsor that if you really do this, and you do it on the inside, when you make this realization, this is not to be placating, but you really start to realize the things that it's talking about here. And you do this, you'll come out the backside, and for the rest of your life, you'll be able to go to meetings anywhere in the world and listen to someone share for 10 or 15 minutes, and you'll know whether they've ever done this or not, because you can see its results, because it changes you. You can never have a victim position again once you do this. You'll never, you can't say, you can be hurt, you can feel hurt, but you'll always know the truth that somehow, some way, based on self, you've positioned yourself in that place to be hurt. That if you sent a CSI team into the pain, they'd find your DNA all over everything. So you start to know that. And this dismantling of the ego shifts everything and changes everything dramatically. To see where I'm wrong, to see, and the difference between, if you haven't done this out of the book, I really encourage you to do this. It's the change is dramatic. I'll give you a couple examples of things that have happened to me as a result. One, I'll talk about this. I go through periods where I don't talk about it for a year or two, and then I talk about it. And I just, and I'm so free of it that I forget to talk about it, yet it's probably one of the most best personal examples I have. When I was a little over 10 years sober, I was married. I'd been in this relationship for about 6 years. We were married for about 4.5. I had a daughter that was almost 2 at the time, who I was just absolutely in love with. I was there when she was born. I held her in my arms. She cried her first tears in my arms. She stole my heart. And when she's almost 2, I ended up going through a divorce as I'm going through it, I don't understand what's happening. Which you'd think, how could a guy go through a divorce and not get what's wrong? But I was that asleep in my own life. And what had happened is, my wife came to me and she wanted a divorce. I talked her out of it. I said, let's try, if you're unhappy, let's try some marriage counseling. I didn't even know you were unhappy. I'm so wrapped up in my stuff, I don't notice you, right? And I didn't know. And I said, we'll try some marriage counseling. So we went to some marriage counseling. And at that time, my sponsor, my first sponsor, had retired, and he bought this bus, one of those RV buses, and he was driving around the East Coast. He was, him and his wife, looking at stuff, and they were at the Kentucky Derby and on and on and on. And I can't get a hold of him. He doesn't have a cell phone. So he calls me once in a while. So I'm in the middle of going through this marriage counseling, which eventually led to my wife saying, I don't want to do the counseling anymore. I want a divorce. And so I'm using a guy, Craig, that I sponsor is my confidant, right? I go to him and talk to him about, because I got to talk to somebody, and he's one of my favorite sponsees. He's an easy guy to talk to. And I'm telling him about all of this. And my wife says, I don't want to do the marriage counseling. I want a divorce. Las Vegas is a weird city. You can get a divorce quick. I mean, an uncontested divorce is fast in Vegas. It's so quick that you are single for 2 weeks and you haven't even got the visa bill yet for the cost of the divorce. I mean, that's how quick it is. And we were divorced on a Thursday, and the next morning, I discovered that my ex-wife of 12 hours and my almost two-year-old daughter had moved in with my confidant, right? And that him and her had been sleeping together the last year of my marriage, right? And I am just crushed. I mean, I'm insane. I'm so insane that I was sponsoring a guy who was, his family owned a big casino, and at one point I had him set me up with an appointment with a hitman. That's a true story. And thank God, that's a whole story of how God worked through to bring me to my senses to not make that appointment. And that was true. That was weird. That's how nuts I was. I was insane. I was nuts. And I couldn't get free of it. And you can't take that to meetings, but I didn't know that. Because if you share that in a meeting, people line up to give you advice. Oh, my God. They'll throw stuff at you, like everything from, like, well, just don't think about it. What are you talking about? One guy comes up to me and says, do you believe in God? I said, yeah, I do. He said, then it shouldn't be a problem. I wanted to say F something, you. I don't know what he's talking about. I believe in God. This is a problem. I can't stop thinking about it. It haunts me. I'm stuck up inside of me with it churning and grinding away, having conversations with both of them continually in my head. I can't listen in meetings. I'm just a basket case. And God took very, very good care of me. And thank God I've always been in service in Alcoholics Anonymous. It saved me from me at times when nothing else would work. And God threw newcomers and people sober. One, Rudy, who was sober 20 years at the time, I think. He was double digit. And I had all these guys come to me all of a sudden, and I'm working with all these guys that have relationship problems, that are all going through breakups and divorces. And so I just pile a bunch of them in my car, and we just go to 3-4 meetings a day. We're like, we just go and become the depressed section of the meeting. I remember I was down at the SOS club one time, and I'm bringing a bunch of these guys who are all mopes into the meeting. And I heard the secretary say to the chairperson, don't call on them. They just take the whole meeting over with relationships and stuff there. But these guys saved me for me because they bought me little islands of relief from myself in my day as I would hear their pain and be temporarily relieved somewhat of mine. It gave me little spots of where I could breathe again for a little bit, and then it would all come back, and it was bad. And I knew the answer. I had taken so many guys through the steps by this point that I knew the answer was in the fourth step, in the resentment freeing process. And so I had to do that. In the book, Sheldon already mentioned this, it talks about six things. And the first thing is you list the people that you're angry at. So I had both their names in the first column. And the second one is the what? Why? Why are you angry at them? And to put down the bullet points. And I think the book implies bullet points. And I think that's important because here's the kind of guy I am. This should be long essay things in column number two. I want to write it out in such detail that when I read it to my sponsor, he goes, oh. They did that. I'm getting the boys together. We're going to go over there in the middle of the night. We're going to make this right. You know, I want to lay it out like that. But no, it's just to the point, to the point, to the point. And then the third thing is I had to see what parts of self were were hurt, threatened, affected, injured, or disturbed or interfered with. And it was everything. It was, my pride was, oh my God, my pride was just crushed. My sex was interfered with. My emotional security, my material security, there's no cheap divorce. My social stuff, my ambitions, pocket, everything. There was nothing unaffected here and hurt. And then the book starts asking me to a question. It says, it's really a statement that it's kind of should be a question, I suppose, before you go on. And it says, we were prepared. Am I prepared to look at this from an entirely different angle? And see, I knew what that meant because I had walked guys through this, that I had to somehow see it through their eyes. I had to somehow put myself in their shoes. I had to somehow imagine that I was them in this situation and see what was driving them to do what they did. And when I was able to do that, I'll tell you, I didn't really like what I saw. When I put myself in the place of my wife, I had fancied myself illusionarily that I was such a great husband because I was a good provider and I never cheated on her and all this other kind of crap, when in actuality I was so wrapped up in my business. I was trying to build this business. There were times I'd work from 8 in the morning till midnight. I'd take an hour and a half off for lunch to go to a meeting, and on my day off I'd go to work for a couple hours and then spend the rest of the day with AA people. Right? I was on a committee for a conference. And the truth was, I wasn't there very much. And I put myself in her place, and I realized here's a gal that had been raised in an alcoholic home, and because of that, she was very timid by nature at that time and had an inability to express conflict or she couldn't tell me that she was unhappy. She wasn't wired that way. So she was more of a passive aggressive kind of person by nature. And I started to see that here's a gal that wasn't involved in AA like I am. It turned out later she wasn't even an alcoholic, and she's fine to this day. She didn't work, and she didn't have a business. She had nothing. She had no sponsees. She had nothing to fill her vacancies with except the marriage, and it was a marriage to a guy who really wasn't there. So she had nothing to fill. She's turning her emptiness to something that's unavailable, right? And I started to get a sense of the loneliness and desolation she must have felt in that marriage, and the inability to, and she just hid it behind a wall of a smile and everything's okay. And when I really, truly, and genuinely could put myself in her shoes, I understood exactly how, if I was in that position, how over time that would work on me until I could easily have had an affair with someone. Easily. And with the knowledge of that also came the understanding of how, of the price I would pay to do that. And Karen paid a tremendous price. It devastated her because it was against her basic nature and principles and her morals to do that. It just about destroyed her. And I got it. You know, the book says we disregard the other person involved entirely. Where are we to blame? And all of a sudden the veils are lifting and I'm seeing through this delusion of what a great husband I was. And I was seeing the truth when I asked myself, where was I selfish? Oh my God, it was all about me, wasn't it? It was all about my job and my business that I'm building and my AA stuff. I never, never once stopped and even asked myself, how's she doing? If I'm doing okay, the world's doing okay. That's how self-centered I am. That's how much I'm the center of the universe. If I'm happy, the world's, everybody else should shape up. If you're not, if you're having a bad, if I'm happy and you're having a bad day, get over it. Right? Shape up, for God's sakes. All right? That's how self-centered I am. It's how selfish I am. Where had I been dishonest? I had this illusion of that I was, you know, an innocent victim in all this. When in actuality, if the day we got married, if I would have gone out to the greatest universities and hired a team of sociologists and psychologists, and I brought them in a room and I gave them an in-depth dossier on her. And I said to them, I said, listen, you got 2 years. You have to come up with a game plan that I could implement that would make this loyal, ethical woman cheat on her husband. Can you give me something that would work to that end? I'm telling you, they couldn't have given me a plan any more effective than what I did, and I don't even know I'm doing it. What's the book say? Sometimes people hurt us seemingly without provocation, without any reason. But we will invariably, which is almost always, we will invariably find that at some time in the past, I have made decisions based on self, which later put those crosshairs right on my forehead, put me in that position to be hurt. And the book says, so we did it. We're the ones that did it. And I started to see, oh my God, I was so wrapped up in me that I positioned myself in that marriage for failure and didn't know I'm doing it. And that is the story of most of our lives, and the problems and the conflicts and the lost jobs and the broken relationships is we make decisions based on self and we don't know we're doing it. We don't know we're positioning ourselves selfishly in life. Because this doesn't tell us that. This explains it all and makes it reasonable. And I had all expect. I thought, well, I have to work all those hours. I have, you know, the justification was I have to. I mean, this is a tremendous opportunity to build a business that will set me in good stead financially for the rest of my life. What an opportunity. I have to do this. And I have to do AA because, my God, I got alcoholism. I can't not do AA. So I had what was seemingly legitimate justifications for my positioning. But there's a deeper truth. The deeper truth is that I don't know how to do intimacy. The deeper truth is that after about 6 months in a relationship, we've talked about every band I like. We've talked about all the movies. We've talked about my childhood. I have given you the whole dossier on everything that's important. It's the Bob dossier. You've heard every joke I have. I run out of things to say. And often, real intimacy is sometimes done in togetherness, even in silence. And I don't know how to do the silence because it feels icky to me. It feels like something's wrong. And so I stay busy. I stay busy, and the opportunity for the business was there, but it was also, in a sense, it was convenient. Because I don't know how to do the home stuff. I don't know how to do it. The AA was necessary, but it was also convenient. And I had to look at this and I had to say, that's me. I positioned myself for this. I signed up for this. I don't know I'm doing it. It wasn't malicious. It wasn't conscious, but I did it just the same because I'm asleep in my own life and I don't get it. There was a guy back in the years when I worked as a therapist, there was a thing that we used, and I don't know if they still use it or not. I've been so disconnected from all that for so long. But it used to be called the Johari window. And the Johari window was a way that you looked at yourself and you looked at others. And there were four pains on the window. And Alcoholics Anonymous takes care of each pain. There's the first pain, which is completely transparent, both directions. That's the pain where I can, it's everything I can see about me and everything you can see about me. It's what I know about me and what you know about me. It's transparent. It's the obvious. The second pain is like one of those mirrors in an interrogation room in a police station where you can see into the room. It's the things I can see about me, but you can't. It's blocked. It's reflective. It's the things I know about me, but I keep secret that nobody else knows about me. And some of the, a big piece of the fourth step is to clear that window. Is to clear that window. The third window, is the crazy window. That's the window of things that you can see about me and I don't have a clue. An old timer knows more about me when I'm new than I do. Because an alcoholic properly armed with information about himself you know stuff about me I don't know. And we could take unfair entertaining advantage of newcomers with that knowledge. I mean, we try not to sometimes, but sometimes we can't help it. Because you can go up to just about any newcomer and look them right in the eye and go, "You've been worrying about yourself a lot lately, haven't you?" And they'll go freak out, man. "Yeah, how'd you know? I mean, whoa." "Well, we know. And you didn't know it until we told you." And you go, "Yeah, I have been, haven't I? Oh, my God." And so the herd here helps us to clean that window. Because you can see it. And we don't beat each other up here with the knowledge we have of each other. We spoon feed it to each other gently. And then the last window is really God's window. It's the more will be disclosed window. It's the things about me that I don't know and you don't know. You can't see them and I can't see them. And yet they're there under the surface affecting my life. And as years go on, God cleans up, makes that little window a little clearer. That's why it's not unusual to be 10, 15, 20, 30 years sober and all of a sudden see something that has been there all along and you couldn't see it until that moment. Because why is that? Well, here's my theory. I think that I've been taking a lot of actions in service, in self-examination, in prayer and meditation over the years, and I've been developing enough grace and it's starting to clear the window a little bit. And more will be disclosed. And so I am starting to not only reduce the separation between me and you and between me and God, but even the separation, the uncanny separation between me and me. You know, I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. I was lost. And I one of the things I envied and sometimes resented in the old timers, in their appearance of comfort, is that they appeared as if they knew exactly who they were and they knew exactly what their life was about. And I'm lost here. I'm spinning in my head. I don't know who I am. I have emotional roller coasters I'm on. I can't tell you. You're new. First time you ever gotten a date, two newcomers? You say, "Where do you want to eat?" "I don't know. Where do you want to eat?" "I don't know. Where do you want to eat?" You just want to get between them and say, "Shut up. Go to McDonald's or something." You know? Because you just spin on that stuff because you don't know. Because you don't even know what you like. You don't even know what you like yet. and stuff that you liked when you were drinking sober, some of that stuff you don't like. And there's some stuff you didn't like when you were drinking that you really like sober. You don't know who you are yet. You don't know who you are. And so Alcoholics Anonymous is not only reducing the separation between me and God, because I got too much self and too much ego between me and God, And the loneliness and separation between me and you, because I got too much self and too much ego between me and you, and I separate myself from you by my judgments, but also from between me and me. And I start to find myself. And to my amazement, this is one of the reasons I love to take people through the steps and watch what happens, is that you find out something that's delightful. The fear is that you're going to, if you really uncovered who you were, that you wouldn't be able to stand that person. The fear is that it's not going to, I'm going to hate this guy. And what the truth is you fall in love with yourself in your imperfections. Because everything that ends, all the objectionable stuff is not you. It's not you. It's who you're not. It's who you are in the bondage of self with an ego that can't stand you being who you are because it wants to be God and it wants to be superior. And so it creates everything, every conflict in my life comes not from who I am, it comes from who I'm not. I heard Sandy Beach tell this story one time, and I thought, this is so, it's so, I've had this experience. It's so right. He said he got sober and he was lost. And he just he didn't know what he wanted, he didn't know anything. He was just adrift, and he's going to meetings every day. And he says he's at this meeting and he's kind of new, and there's a brand new guy there. And the guy comes to the meeting and he can't even get a cup of coffee. He's shaking like this. And Sandy said he sat there and he watched him. And he watched him sit down and he remembered when he shook like that. And he doesn't shake like that anymore. And he went home that night and he started thinking to himself, man, I should have talked to that guy. I should have talked to that guy. Maybe I could have said something. Maybe he needed a friend. I should have talked to that guy. Why didn't I talk to that guy? And he goes back the next week to that group and he gets there early. And he's sitting there and he's waiting for the guy because he wants to talk to the guy. And the guy doesn't show up and he's sitting there and he's just anguishing. Man, I know I should have talked to that guy. 5 minutes after the meeting starts, the guy comes into the meeting and Sandy says, I lit up. And he walked over to the coffee and with a steady hand, he poured himself a cup of coffee. And he said something inside of him just wanted to go, yeah, yeah. And he said, that's the real me. That's been the real me all along. It's the person inside of me that's because of the fear has not come out to do what it does the best, and that is to love. And so Alcoholics Anonymous is going to introduce you to the most important person in your life. Because I am God's first gift to me. And if I don't find a way to get right with me, then I'm not going to be right with anything. Because if I'm not introduced to who I really am and come away in love with that person, then I'm not going to love anything else either. And you can't love yourself directly. I mean, you can, but you'll go blind eventually. Why do I say those kind of things? That's like, just comes out of me. It's like the devil gets in me. Yeah, right. Well, I got glasses. Yeah. I'll tell you one more quick story and I'll turn it over to Sheldon. There's a power in this process, in this was our course, and coupled with the prayer, because everything in Alcoholics Anonymous that has, see, there's no power in us, and there's no power in the intellectual process. It has to be these actions coupled with God's grace. God's the fuel. He's the power. And so, we in this was our course, we change our perception. And many years ago, probably 25 years maybe ago, I guess. No, God, it's been longer than that. Because this guy's sober as long as Craig. Maybe even a year long. Almost as long. Probably this is probably 27 years ago. I'm listening to his fifth step, and he had an alcoholic dad who was brutal. I mean, bad. This guy was a bad drunk, and he was very violent. And he would go into these rages, and he would beat this poor kid repeatedly. And I'm not talking about a few incidences. This is a childhood horror. Broken bones, contusions, in and out of the emergency room. And it was back at a time when they didn't look for child abuse. So if a kid was in the emergency room with a broken arm and he told him a story about a bicycle wrecker falling out of a tree, they just patched the arm up and let the kid go. And he had spent years in therapy trying to get free of this resentment. It owned him. It affected his ability to have relationships. It affected his ability to work and be a team player. I mean, he couldn't even have friends as a kid because he couldn't bring them home because he didn't know what was going to be home. He didn't know. And he was so ashamed of what happens at home that it was his big secret, right? And here we are in the fourth step, and we're getting about partway in, and he's talking about his dad and all the beatings and the abuse and the yelling and it was horrible. And in the book, it says that we should be prepared to look at this from an entirely different angle. And so it is my job when I listen to a fifth step to try to facilitate that and to be helpful from my experience if possible. And then God seems to sometimes intuitively help us to do this. And I started walking the guy through this. And, there's a passage in the 12 Steps and 12 Traditions in Step 10 where Bill expounds on this spiritual principle of this was our course. And this is not a direct quote, but he says something in there like, as we approach true tolerance and see what real love actually means, it becomes more and more apparent that all people, including ourselves, are frequently wrong as well as emotionally ill, and we start to realize that all of us are suffering from the pains of growing up. And Bill's trying to other-center us into the people we're in conflict with. And I came back to the book, and I started reading This Was Our Course. And it says, and I changed the tense of it. So I said, you must realize how your dad who wronged you, how the person who had wronged you was perhaps spiritually sick. And though you did not like what he did to you and how that affected you in column number 3, you have to realize that you're like him, spiritually sick. And when he heard me imply that he was like his father, he flipped out, man. He just got so defensive, and he's like on a screaming, and you just all this venom's coming out. I'm not like my father. He's on this roll, this rant, and which is a little frightening. And when he ran out of gas, he's sitting there and he's just glaring at me, And I didn't know what to say to him. I all I could think of is he's not prepared to look at this from an entirely different angle. I guess I don't know. Which happens sometimes. That happened with Sheldon and his dad. I just sat there and thought, maybe he's not prepared. I don't know. And so I just went on. I said, go to the next resentment. And he's reading the next resentment, and something's cooking in me. And this happens a lot in service and usefulness. God will work through you. And what happened is I stopped him and I said, I want to go back to one of the other resentments. And it was a resentment in the very beginning where he had talked about this woman he had been with for a number of years, and they had kids and they all lived together. And through his drunkenness and other stuff, she eventually rejected him, and he was pissed at her and he had to move out and et cetera, et cetera. And I just said to him, I said, there were kids there, right? He said, yeah. I said, look, I'm just wondering if there was ever a time when you were drunk or stoned on drugs or hungover where you might have done anything to hurt those kids. And all the blood ran out of his face. And he put his head down, and I don't know what's going on with this guy. And he, when he lifted his head up, he had a tear running down one side. I remember the voice. It was the voice. He said this horrible whisper. He could almost choking on the words. He said, "I'm just like my goddamn father." I said, "How did you feel about yourself when you hurt those kids?" And he said, "I couldn't stay drunk enough." I said, "You think your dad might be like that?" And he got this little look in his eyes like, "Maybe. I don't know." And he said, he says, "I don't know." He said, "I haven't seen my dad for a long time." No one in the family would have anything to do with the father except the one sister who kept, out of some sense of duty, I suppose, kept going over and visiting him intermittently. And he said, "I don't know." He said, "My dad can't drink anymore." He said he's got such a bad liver and a pancreas. His body literally won't metabolize alcohol. And he said, "My sister said he's the most depressed, lonely, negative person she's ever known." Because what's it like when you can't, you're forced to not drink? Man. I said, "Do you think that could be you?" And he said, "You know, maybe," at one point he said, "maybe my father is a vision of my future without Alcoholics Anonymous." And for the first time in his life, it wasn't that he was, it's not saying what his dad did wasn't wrong. It's starting to other-center yourself enough to understand, to put yourself in your dad's shoes and realize that if you had been raised like he had been raised, if you had been hurt like he had been hurt, if you were scared like he was scared, can you come off the high horse enough to understand that if all those things were inside of you, driving you, that you are capable of being that guy? You'd hate yourself for being that guy, but you're capable. And he started to understand that. And he went to, the book says, we disregard the other person involved entirely. This is not about looking for your part. Because if I'm going to look for my part, okay, here's my part. Right? Well, the implication is I'm reserving the right to think they have a part. The book says the opposite. It says we put out of our minds the wrongs others have done. And so he had to look dead on. What kind of a son was I? And he said, I was a horrible son. He used his dad's alcoholism and his dad's sickness and his dad's emotional sickness and rage to justify borrowing thousands and thousands of dollars from his dad and never paying a dime back because his dad's an asshole. He justified talking crap about himself, about his dad, and grandizing himself to all the friends and family until he literally had turned most of the people against his father, except for the one sister. And he'd puff himself up as he put his dad down. And when he took a look at this, he said, "Oh my God, and my dad couldn't help being the way he was any more than I could help being the way I was when I was the way I was." And he started to see past the symptoms to the real core of the sickness. And what he saw in his father was the same thing that was in him. I think that's what happens, is we start to see ourselves in the person we resent. And when you start to get that, it's like the judgment starts to dissolve, because it's an erroneous judgment. I think that I've labeled this guy something. That's not him. That's not his. The label doesn't fit. That's me. That's me maybe with more hurt. That's me maybe with a little worse childhood. That's me with maybe a lot of fear. That's me on a very bad day. But that's me. And if I haven't done something that someone has done to me, it's not by virtue. It's not because I'm you know, that we all feel that smug superiority. That's BS. It's just I haven't been driven by what was driving them. And then all of a sudden, guys like me and guys like him, we start to join the human race. And for the first time, some of us, the first time in our life, we'd start to develop, I think, the highest form of spirituality. It's called compassion. It comes from the Latin cum, meaning with, and passio, meaning pain. Is that I can start to sit with your pain I get you. I'm not offended by your sickness and symptoms anymore. That is in me sometimes. I have compassion for you. I get it. I see beyond the irritants to what's really going on. I'm awake. And in this, some of us, for the first time in our lives, start to grow an understanding and effectiveness, which later on in the book says we must continue for a lifetime. Sheldon.
I think that a lot of where the difference for me is in what we do in Alcoholics Anonymous and what happens in therapy is what happens in what Bob just talked about. Therapy is very valuable stuff, I think. I think that therapy's been helping people for a long, long time, and a lot of people have fantastic and productive lives today because of the work that they've done in therapist's office. So I don't want anybody to think for a minute that I'm talking down about the great work that therapists do. But there is a difference between what happens in Alcoholics Anonymous and especially in the fourth step than the work that happens in a therapist's office. And it looks only slightly different. It can be difficult almost to see the distinction between the two. Because what happens in a therapist's office, I think a lot of times, is incredibly valuable because what happens is we sit and we talk about our lives and the people in our lives and we find out where the people in our lives have wronged us and the harms that they've done to us, and then we find ways to forgive them for the wrongs that they have done, which can be incredibly valuable. But it is radically different from what we do in Alcoholics Anonymous, because what we do in Alcoholics Anonymous is we look at the people in our lives and the way they've affected us and disturbed us and the things that have happened in our lives. And we look at those situations and we try to find out where we were wrong. And then we apologize for what we have done. And the difference is subtle but huge. And the results are we are either victims and prisoners or we are volunteers and free. And it is the freedom that Alcoholics Anonymous gives me that is so vital to my spirit, that for me to sit in blame of other people is to leave myself locked in that prison cell that I came here in. So the next list that we do, we've done our resentment list, and the next thing that we're going to look at is our fear list. And when I got to Alcoholics Anonymous, I didn't think I was very afraid at all. I mean, you grow up as a young man and you know, you're not, if I'm angry, I can see resentments. I could see why I'd have to write a resentment list, but I don't think I'm afraid. I mean, if I am afraid, I'm certainly not going to tell you I'm afraid. I mean, you can go to the bar and tell the guys, you know, what's wrong? I'm having a terrible day. I'm angry at everybody. But you can't go to the bar and say, I'm having a terrible day. I'm slightly insecure and terribly afraid. I mean, it's just not something that I'm prepared to do. I think one of the reasons why I struggled with the fear inventory originally is because I imagined it was a separate list than the resentment list. I imagined that I was going to do a resentment list and then I was going to do a fear list, as if these lists were separate. And they are separate in the actual action that I take. But I've sat in book studies, I've even facilitated book studies where we've talked about these steps as if the resentment list is a separate entity from the fear list. And when I do that, I think I miss a big piece of the point. It says in the book that notice the word fear is bracketed along the difficulties with Mr. Brown, Mr. Jones, the employer, and his wife. This short word somehow touches every aspect of our lives. And over on 65, in the example that Bill gives of what those first three columns of a four-step word look like, there are many different things that are affected. each one of those resentments, sometimes it's his self-esteem that's affected, sometimes it's his pocketbook, sometimes it's his sexual relations, but depending on the resentment, there are different things that are affected, but next to each one of them, in every case, is the word fear. I got a resentment against a guy. I'm like Brown. I got a guy at my work that I think wants to steal my job. And I'm resentful at the guy because he wants to steal my job. He wants my job. I was in the car business for a lot of years, and I worked my way up in that business to the general manager's chair. And one of the things about the general manager's chair is that everybody thinks they can be a general manager. Everybody in every company thinks they can run the company better than the guy running the company. It's part of running the company. That's just what happens. The guy sitting next to me in the chair next to me, he thinks he should be able to run the company. He wants my job. And I'm mad at the guy. But when I work through this with my sponsor, what am I really mad at the guy for? I'm mad at the guy because he's threatening my job. What do I think? I think, what if the owner of the company thinks that he might do a better job than me? What if the owner of the company takes a look at him and thinks, you know, I'm paying Sheldon this, I'm paying this guy this, this guy thinks he can do the job, let's pay him this, and get rid of Sheldon. And I'm threatened. So I'm afraid. There's fear in every one of my resentments. If the lot porter thought that he could do the general manager's job, I wouldn't resent the lot porter because I'm not afraid. I have to be afraid in order for me to have a resentment. If some guy's hitting on my wife and he's a 30-year-old guy that's built at the gym and he's wearing fancy clothes and he looks the part, I might be afraid. I got no real reason to be afraid. I'm married to my wife for 16 years, together 18 years. She's the loyalest woman on the planet. I have no real reason to be afraid. But if he looks the part, I might be afraid. If he's 800 pounds and smells of garlic, no resentment. The only way the resentment can exist is if it is fueled by the fear. So I do the resentment list, and it reveals the things that I am afraid of. It lets me see all my petty insecurities. It lets me see all the people in my life that I've been angry at, that I can understand that the reason I'm angry at is because I'm either being interfered with. Something is preventing me getting from what it is that I think that I should have. Or I'm being affected. Maybe I'm not quite getting it the way that I want to get it. Maybe it's making it more difficult for me to get what I want. Or it's being threatened. Maybe nothing really is happening at all, but it's all in my mind. It's being threatened. Notice the word fear is bracketed alongside the difficulty with Mr. Brown, Mr. Jones, the employer, and his wife. This short word somehow touches every aspect of our lives. It was an evil and corroding thread. The fabric of our existence was shot through it. In my house, on our couch, we've got a blanket that's folded over the back of the couch like many people have in their home. When you walk into my room and you look at the couch, you can clearly see that it's a red blanket. The blanket on the couch is red. But when you get close to the blanket and you look at it, there are green threads that run all the way through the blanket. In fact, if you get close and take a proper look at that blanket, you couldn't again say it's a red blanket. You would have to say it was a red and green blanket. But when I look at my life and I first think about how I am, I think I'm angry, I think I'm resentful, I think my life is a red blanket. But when I start getting close and looking at my life, the fabric of my life is shot through. There are these green threads of fear that run through my entire life. And the book makes this funny comment. It says it set in motion trains of circumstances which brought us misfortune we felt we didn't deserve. This fear brings into our life misfortune, or if you like, resentment and anger that we felt we didn't deserve. When we start our fourth step, we start off with this list of people that we think secretly owe us an amends. We start off with this list of people that we're angry at. I'm angry at them. This is what they did. This is how it made me feel. And God damn it, they should fix it. And then we end up taking the journey to see this is how it might have felt to be them. This is what it might have been like if I was in their shoes. This is what I did wrong. This is where I was selfish, self-centered. This is where I was at fault, and this is what I should have done instead. And what I end up with is, if I would have done this instead, if I could have behaved properly, they may never have done this. This may never have happened, and I may never have had the resentment. And why did I behave that way? What drove me to do the behavior that set the ball rolling? When I look at the resentments, it's clear, as Bob talked about, that I step on the toes of my fellows, and they retaliate, seemingly without provocation. Why do I step on the toes of my fellows? Well, it's because when I look out at the world, I don't look out at the world as if it's a friendly place. I look out at the world as if I'm coming from behind. I look out at the world as if I'm being threatened. I look out at the world as if I'm living behind enemy lines. I look out at the world as if somehow I've gotten dropped off where the opposing army is, and nobody's really on my side. And if I'm not worried about my life, and if I'm not making sure I'm not getting my own, if I'm not worried about my plans and designs, if I'm not the guy in 60 through 63, who's going to be? Who's going to look after my finances if I don't? Who's going to? Who cares about my money? Who's going to look after and make sure that my sex life is protected if I don't? If I'm not lustful, I might never get laid. If I'm not greedy, I might not have any money. If I'm not out there trying to make sure that you think I'm wonderful, I might not have any friends. If I'm not constantly, always aware of all the threats in the universe and everybody that's out to get whatever it is that I feel like I should be mine, what's going to happen to me? And this is how I approach life. And it's no wonder that I end up rubbing up against everybody and everything in the world. A guy that lives that way is going to be a resentment manufacturing machine. I'm going to have a mind that overanalyzes and overjustifies and overscrutinizes. And nobody could handle the pressure that I'm going to put on them the way I'm going to look at them with my magic magnifying glass. Somewhere in between resentment and fear is where I really start to own the stuff that Bill writes in 60 through 63. I start to really see that I'm the director that runs the whole show. Somewhere in between resentment and fear is where I really get to understand that I am the guy that has to have things the way he thinks they should be and will do anything. Be angry, indignant, self-sacrificing, sometimes even nice, kind, or gracious, as the case may be, to get things the way that I think that they should be. And terrified, I approach the world. Terrified, I approach the world. We think that fear ought to be classed with stealing. It seems to cause more trouble. Oh, boy. I'm just the guy that I'm afraid. I'm afraid of everything. I don't apply for jobs that I don't think I'm going to get because I don't think I'm going to get them, so I don't apply for them. They wouldn't hire a guy like me, so I'm not going to go apply for that job. I'm 47 years old, and I tell you the funniest thing, I don't have a college degree, and I want a college degree. I really would like a college degree. I don't know why I want a college degree. I want a college degree. Got sober, 28 years old. Could have had a college degree by now. Didn't get a college degree because I thought I was too old, shouldn't get a college degree. Why would you go back to school at 28? I'm afraid to go back to school, besides I'm stupid. I mean, that's the truth, right? I won't pass the class. It takes 4 years to go to college. Would have had a college degree at 34. Know what 34 I thought? I'd like a college degree. Could have had one already. Didn't have a college degree. Didn't get one. Didn't go to get one. Thought I was too old. It was too late. Not going to get a college degree. Besides, I'll never pass the class. I'm stupid. Not going to get one. When I was 38, could have had a college degree. Thought to myself, I'd like to have a college degree. You want to know what's really pathetic? I'm 47 years old next week. Glad it's not this week, because I wouldn't want to go through what you went through. I'm not going to be nowhere. Nobody knows it's my birthday next week. That's the damn show. I'm going to be 47 years old next week, and I know something for sure. I'm not going to have a college degree. And when I'm 51 years old, I'll wish I had a college degree. It's just kind of a funny deal, right? But I'm afraid, and my fear steals from me job opportunities, relationships. I tell you a crazy story. When I met my wife, I was very newly sober. I got sober on July 17th of 1996. My wife showed up at the AA club 4 days later on July 21st of the same year. And when she walked in the room, I thought, man, that is a beautiful girl. It's not exactly what I thought, but it was, that's a much cleaner version of what I thought. But it's kind of along the same lines of what I thought. It's what I would have liked to have thought. It's really what I thought. But when she walked in the room, I thought, man, that's a beautiful girl. I would love to get with a girl like that, but a girl like that would never look at a guy like me, because a guy like me doesn't deserve a girl like that. And we became friends, and we'd go out to coffee, and I'd sit across from her having coffee, and I'd think to myself, man, I wish a girl that pretty would be my girlfriend, but a girl that pretty would never be my girlfriend, because a girl like that doesn't go out with a guy like me, because a guy like me doesn't deserve a girl like that, so I'm not going to ask that girl to be my girlfriend. And we'd go and we'd hang out together, and we spent a lot of time together. We were very close friends, and I'd go to my sponsor, I'd say, Bob, I said, you know, man, I just wish that she'd be my girlfriend, but I can't say nothing to her, because I'm afraid to say something to her, because if I say something to her, I know what's going to happen. She's going to reject me, it's going to be embarrassing, I'm going to feel really bad, and besides, I'm going to lose a good friend. And she's a good friend, I like her as a friend, she's a good friend. She can be my friend, you know, and a girl like that would never want to be with a guy like me. And he got sick of hearing me whining about this girl. Now he's 65 now, but he wasn't always 65. And he was a younger man with less gray and more red in his hair at the time, and he was a single guy, and he got so sick of hearing. He would try everything. He would, you know, God doesn't want you to be alone, Sheldon. God would want you to be happy. You know, what's the worst thing if you ask her out and she says no? What's the worst thing that would happen? You know, all this stuff. And I just was terrified. I couldn't do nothing. He says, well, she seems like a nice girl. I'll tell you what, give me a number. I'll go out with her. Oh, he seems nice in Bethlehem. You should try being sponsored by him, right? So now I'm thinking to myself, you know what's going to happen now is I'm going to lose this girl and I'm going to lose my sponsor. Not completely. Now I'm not only going to be a 40-year-old virgin, I'm going to be drunk too. And this is just a bad deal, right? My life is over. So I finally, that night, and we go out for dinner, her and I, and I'm terrified, and but I got to say something, and I never forget, I'm messing with this napkin, twisting it. She goes, what's wrong with you? And I said, well, I said, spit up a fur ball, and I said, you know, I said, well, you know, I said, I got to tell you, I said, I've been sitting here, we've been doing this for months and months and months, and I'm crazy about you. And she said, what do you think we should do about that? And I don't know why I said it. I said, well, I think we should go to your place. And she said she thought so too, and that was the beginning of our relationship. And she told me later that she had given me every sign and every signal that she knew how to give, and she had just decided that I was going to be her gay friend. I'm glad you find this funny. This is my pathetic life, but we really are a sick bunch. But but when it says that fear ought to be classed with stealing, her and I have been together 18 years, married 16 years. We have an amazing relationship, a beautiful son. I could have missed it all. Because I think I know what's going to happen, and I think it's going to be bad, and I'm afraid of what the outcome's going to be. And I always assume the worst. I never assume the best. Never, ever, 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 when I think about how things are going to work out, do I end up giggling with anticipation about how wonderful they're going to be. I'm just not wired that way. I'm just not wired that way. I have to work very, very hard in Alcoholics Anonymous every single day for me to have an outlook of life that says it'll probably be okay. I have to work very, very hard every day in Alcoholics Anonymous to end up with an outlook of life of where it would probably be okay. So what do I do with my fears? We review our fears thoroughly. We put them on paper. Even though we had no resentment in connection with them, and I believe that every one of my fears has triggered a resentment, but we put them on paper whether we see the resentment or not. We don't have to see the resentment to write the fear. And we asked ourselves why we had them. Wasn't it because self-reliance had failed us? You know, when you look at my life, if you look at the way I've lived my life, if I'm afraid that I'm going to get fired from my job. I'm afraid I'm going to get fired from my job. Well, Sheldon, what kind of an employee are you?
Well, I think I'm a great employee.
Well, are you? Do you show up on time early every day? When you say on time, do you mean like... Because on time to me is when I start at 9. If I'm there before the boss shows up at 9:15, I'm doing pretty good. Do you work all day hard? Do you give them a dime for their nickel? Do you do the best job you can? Do you talk about the boss behind his back? Do you ever take pens or paper home with you that don't belong to you? You ever call in sick when you're not sick? You ever do anything that might make your boss, if he knew about it, might make him look down or badly at you? Maybe not at your current job. Maybe since you've been sober, maybe you're sober 5 or 10 years, and in the last 5 or 10 years, you've done the very, very best job that you could possibly do, and you've been a good employee. But before you got sober, what kind of an employee were you? I mean, based on your history, Sheldon, you should probably be afraid that you're going to get fired. I mean, quite honestly, Sheldon, based on the kind of employee you've been, you'd be an idiot not to be afraid that you're probably going to get fired. I'm afraid she's going to cheat on me. Well, how do you treat her? You know what I find myself sometimes in my marriage? I'm having a bad day, and I'll be nicer to the girl at the grocery store checking out my Wheaties than I am to the woman who I am supposed to love more than anything on this planet. Sometimes my behavior, and especially in past relationships, have you always been faithful? What have your actions been like? Do you act like a guy that deserves the love and the trust of another person? Sometimes, not always. Based on your past history, does it make sense you should be afraid? Based on your own, how you've lived your life, based on these actions in 60 through 63, based on how you live, does it make sense that you should have fear in your life because of how self-will has been? Boy, when you line my life up with that stuff in 60 through 63, the way that I live in selfishness, self-obsession, always thinking about me, being self-centered, not caring about you, no compassion, always trying to run the show, always trying to make sure that things go the way that I think things should be, arranging the lights in the ballet, trying to get people to behave the way that they think they should, reacting to fear, the way that I live my life, I should be afraid. Wasn't it because self-reliance had failed us? Self-reliance was good as far as it went, but it didn't go far enough. Some of us once had great confidence, but it didn't fully solve the fear problem or any other when it was cocky, when we were cocky, it made it worse. Screw you. I was looking for a job when I found this one. That's my credo as I'm walking out of the last job that I got fired from. I don't want to be friends with those people. They're too clicky. I'm not interested in her. She's a snob. I get cocky and I push people and push things further away. Screw them, screw you, screw it, F this, F that, F them. I get pumped up and this false pride and ego. And I push people and things further away, and there is no solution to the fear and the loneliness that I've increased by my reaction to the results of me living on self-will. To the list of resentments that I have. Every person that's come close to me in my life, I'm either angry at them or they're angry at me. I found a way to burn up every relationship and to spoil every good opportunity. It's no wonder I'm afraid. The book says perhaps there's a better way. We better hope so. We think so. For we're now on a different basis, the basis of trusting and relying upon God. Well, when are we on that basis? Why does it say we're on that basis? Because we did a third step. We offered ourselves to God to build with us for the future and to do with us right now our will and our life, our thoughts and our actions. We've turned our will and our life over to the care of God. We must trust infinite God rather than our finite selves. I believe that my journey into spirituality, my journey towards God has been a very practical and pragmatic journey. It's been a journey of me saying that my life isn't working the way that it's working, so I'm just going to try and trust God and see what happens. The way that I was introduced to a spiritual experience was I was introduced to God in a way of saying, what you're doing isn't working. Let's pretend that God exists and see what the results are. And if what we get are positive results, then we can look back and say, yes, God exists or God doesn't exist. So I've got this fear in my life and I'm challenged with acting like God exists. And my sponsor would say to me, you know, I've come to him with a problem. This has happened or that's happened. I'm frustrated about this or I'm afraid of that. And he would say to me, what would a guy do that believed in God? Not you, Sheldon. But a guy that believed in God. What would a guy do that believed and trusted in a power greater than himself that was an active member of Alcoholics Anonymous with 12 golden steps in his life? Not you, Sheldon. But a guy that believed and trusted in God. So I come to this world, I come to this life with these fears and these anxieties and these certain calamities that I can see, these problems that Bob's talking about that I can see before they even become problems. We are worriers. We are people that create visions of the future. I always write horror stories. I never write love stories. I'm not in the happy ending business. But the question is, what would a guy like me do if he believed in God? I'm not capable of taking that leap of faith to believe in God. It feels false to me. It feels vacant to me. It feels like there's a hole in that theory. But what I am capable of doing is I am capable of acting as if God exists and then later looking to see what the results in my life are. And that's the challenge that I'm given here in Alcoholics Anonymous. We trust infinite God rather than our finite selves. We're in the world to play the role that he assigns. My job in life is to try and be the best Sheldon that I can be. That I show up in the world and I show up in Alcoholics Anonymous, trying to help God's kids and trying to do the best I can and not expecting to be perfect and knowing that I'm flawed and knowing that I'll make mistakes and trusting and hoping that God will allow me to do the best that I can for him. Just to the extent that we do as we think he would have us and humbly rely upon him, does he enable us to match calamity with serenity. There's that great prayer by Thomas Morton where he says that I do not know, Lord, and I'm going to say this wrong. I promise I'm going to say it wrong. Where it says, God, I do not know what it is that you want me to do. I do not know what pleases you, Lord. But I do think that my trying to please you pleases you. I don't know what God wants from me. I don't have a hotline to God. The people that have a hotline to God, that God talks directly to them, they got a red phone on the side of the bed, and when they ring, it's the holy hotline. They scare me. Right? They scare me. I'm not that hooked up or connected. So I don't really know what God wants of me. Sometimes I think the best sense I get is I get a sense of what God's will for me is not. That sense often is clearer for me than what his will is for me. But I believe that God loves the fact that I try to do what it is that he wants me to do. We never apologize for God depending on our creator. It says, all men of faith have courage. You know, when I was newly sober, you don't hear this very much anymore, but you used to hear this an awful lot. You would hear this joke that people would tell, that when fear knocks, faith answers, and there's nobody there. And I'm really glad you don't hear that very much, because the implication of that is that if you have faith, you will not have fear. Which scares the living daylights out of me, right? Because I got a lot of faith. I believe in God. I'm certain God exists. I really am. I got a lot of faith. But I'm often afraid. I'm often afraid. Some mornings I'll wake up in the morning and the sunlight will come through my bedroom window and it'll land on my body and I'll think to myself, oh my God, my wife's going to notice she married a fat guy and it's all... Oh, man. I'm afraid I'm going to get to work and they're going to see that you? We didn't mean to hire you. I'm going to get pulled over and they'll find a warrant for something I didn't do in a town I didn't live in. I'll have to go serve time in some crap hole jail that I'm just afraid of everything, right? But the verdict of the ages is that faith means courage. And the courage is the ability to do the right thing in spite of fear. Courage means that scared to death, I do the next kind and loving thing. If I wasn't afraid, I wouldn't need courage. People that aren't afraid don't need to be brave. If I wasn't afraid, I wouldn't need God. Could you imagine where I would be in my life if I was afraid of nothing? I don't know about you, but I have this weird thing about me that unless I'm constantly reminded I need to turn to God, I quit turning to God. Right? It is the fear that drives me in this world to remind me that what I am lacking is the courage, and I turn to God and I ask for the courage, and God lets me feel as if I can be okay. Instead, we let him demonstrate through us what he can do. We ask him to remove our fear and direct us, our attention, to what he would have us be. What he would have us be. I don't believe that God in my life works as much in the physical plane as he does in the spiritual plane. I don't know whether or not I really believe that God is going to help me get my next job. I don't know if I believe that. Maybe he will, maybe he won't, I don't know. I'm in between jobs, I guess I kind of hope he does. But I'm not sure that he works that way. I'm not sure that God's in the employment agent business. I'm not sure he's going to help me get my next house. I'm not sure if God's a realtor. I'm not sure about that. I'm not sure if he's going to help you get your next girlfriend or boyfriend. I'm not sure if God's a pimp. I'm just not sure. I'm just not sure that that's the way that works. I think the way that it works is God really cares how I behave at my next job, and he will help me behave appropriately so I can be the most effective. I think God will help me to behave and have the kind of home that he's welcome to come in and that my home can be an effective and loving place where people can come and joy and grow. I hope that in my relationship that I'm in currently, and in your relationship that you are in currently, or the next one that comes down the pike, I hope that God helps you to be a kind and caring, loving, compassionate partner that will enable that relationship to encompass three lives, your life, their life, and the life you share together, so it is the most beautiful and peaceful and prosperous and joyous thing that it can be together. I think that's how God works. That God will enable me to treat and act as kids in spite of fear, in a way that won't cause all the goddamn resentments I just got through inventorying. That if I can trust and rely upon God, I can minimize the number of resentments I'll have when we talk about step 10 later. Let's break for lunch, guys. Oh, some announcements before we break.